kind of smiling as you were doing the bio. Every time I hear my bio, two things happen. One is it feels like I don't know who they're talking about. Like, all of that is true, but I don't know who you're talking about. And then the other thing is that this, I went to teach somewhere, and they read the bio, and it was like a long bio, and it sounds like from that bio, like I really have it together, yeah. But that was the day when I actually managed to show up to teach mindfulness with my fly down. So these are important reflections on self, actually. So maybe let's just settle in for a few minutes. Just noticing what we do or think we're supposed to do to begin meditating. When we sit down in the stillness and silence, we are really asking ourselves, what is it like to be human? So we ask this question, and as we sit together for a few minutes, we seek answers. Seek to look with honest eyes. What is it like to be human? And we practice opening to the human condition. how can we begin to make peace with the human condition? Of course, the attention goes wandering off looking for pleasure and satisfaction in the world of thought. Like the mind is hungry and looking for something to eat. And our thoughts are the best food available. And that's fine. The mind is doing what it can, what it's been conditioned to do, to take care of us. To imagine the future, to rehearse the past, to try and find a way towards happiness. And so we can't blame the mind for that. Because we've underestimated the nourishment that is here So I wanted to begin by hearing a bit from you. What's relevant about this this practice and around this topic of anger and aversion, letting go, and what your intentions are for your practice around these kinds of themes. So anybody is welcome.
I work with young people who have many have experienced trauma, mm-hmm. and there's just almost like a chronic, kind of low grade, ready to trigger sort of anger in them.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. It does sometimes. We can kind of sense that there's a sort of emotional idol point in us. Cars, a car engine, right? The normal idol is at like 500 RPMs or something, yeah? And then there are sometimes, if it's really cold or something and you start the car, it's idling at 1500 RPMs. And I noticed that that there are different kind of emotional idol points for people and also within a single person. So I know there are situations where, you know, I know what my baseline feels like. Yeah. And then I know what 1500 RPMs feels like. But I don't always recognize that I'm idling at a higher level. If we can recognize that we are at, in whatever the situation is, often with the people we actually love most, the idol point is higher, yeah? And it's like we're sensitized to everything, yeah? Knowing that is critical. And sometimes some people through their own conditioning, that set point is higher, yeah. And part of what that does for me, actually, is when we look at somebody and we see, and I've done a lot of work with kids with traumatic histories who have that kind of higher set point, and when we look at behavior that really does not make sense for them, it's harmful to others, and there's that real tendency for, you know, to condemn it. If we can actually reflect on something like that idol point, yeah? Like, I know if I were idling there, I would be just as reactive, actually, yeah? And so it's not to condone harm, and that is part of our commitment, is actually making a kind of clear ethical commitment not to harm. And that's important, and that actually gives us the freedom to feel everything we feel, to think everything we think. It makes our practice safer in a way because we know we're committed not to harm it. So it's not to condone harm, but it does help us understand for sure. Thanks. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
And along those lines, I've realized at times I've been very angry, but I generally in the past have pressed it down, kept myself from doing something constructive in my anger. So I'm learning to be in touch with my anger, and use it to make some positive changes.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. sometimes the Buddhist teachings and teachings around, acceptance and the very language I was using, making peace with the human condition, opening the heart, this can be kind of, it can sound like it's asking for some kind of passivity. But in anger, I think especially, there are times when the resolution of anger requires action. It actually requires action. It's not, probably most of the time, it requires, as Shanti Deva says, that we sit like a log, don't do anything. That's probably most of the time. But there are definitely times when anger cannot be resolved through our own internal practice, that we actually have to set a limit or express something or address some injustice or actually act in a way. But the suggestion is that action and acceptance are not fighting one another. That what is accepted is our own psychological, emotional, physical responses to what's happening. That's what we accept. Right now, anger is arising, and we make peace with that. And then it's from that platform of peace that we can decide whether we sit like a log or say something, do something. Yeah. But the actions that emerge out of that kind of bedrock of openness, settledness, concentration, the actions that arise from that are likely to be much more effective than, if I let my reactive habits drive the show and propel me into action. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
What I've noticed is, as I kind of get more and more mindful, I realize that I get a lot of anger when I'm driving. And yeah. I come to realize, if I'm more mindful and I know exactly when I get angry, I've finally figured that out. After the end of the day, I'm hungry, I'm driving home, people aren't driving the way they're supposed to.
Yeah.
They're not driving, they're not turning when they should,
Yeah.
There's plenty of space, and I get upset about it, but recently I've been trying to be more and more mindful, so I will actually cut it off and I'll say to myself, okay, this is the time of day when I get angry about people driving. So I kind of keep an eye on it, and it helps.
Yeah. Driving possibly is like the last frontier of our anger practice, And the point you make around sort of, noticing I'm hungry, or this is the state of my mind, or that is so, it's so valuable, because so much of what comes out, it's like we can have whole world views, like literally whole philosophies about human nature and politics and the future of civilization. We can have entire philosophies that are birthed out of particular mind states, And if we don't recognize, like I'm tired and tired, hungry, it's like we get seduced by that whole gestalt, like that whole thing. And it feels, when it's so compelling, yeah? And we can get really tripped out on, we really can build whole philosophies around driving and what we, what that means about people and all of this. And it's not to say there's no discernment there, like it's not to say that people should be like actively texting on the highway or whatever. It's not to say that, right? But it is to say that that if we're not conscious of the kind of psychophysiological state of our being, we really can have like such strong allegiance to a view that literally might change as soon as we have a piece of toast.
Right.
You know, and so like, okay, you look at the worldview before the toast and after the toast, right? It's like, whoa, that's trippy. But that stuff happens a lot, and not just with hunger, you know? Anyway, thanks. Yeah,
I was wondering about non-harming when you're being attacked.
Yeah.
By a family member, that's my situation. And it's been going on. I realized I had to set limits and not be around this person because of the behavior was so harmful. But not to react until I had a sense of what would be the wise thing to do. This person uses strong speech. I mean, you know, really comes across very and believes, you know, that their position is correct. And it's like walking on eggs around this person. And so I'm wondering, you know, when I'm in that situation with that particular person, I just don't want to make anything to upset that person because the reaction is so extreme.
Yeah.
And so I wondered what you might suggest in those situations.
Maybe what... How about this? How about we... Let's revisit it at the end of the day. Because at some level, I think much of what we'll talk about should be relevant for that. But it probably won't answer everything, yeah. And so let's revisit it. And just one suggestion would be to make the practice around anger and limit setting and open-heartedness and non-harming, to make that practice bigger than that person, bigger than that relationship, yeah? Like, don't allow your, don't reduce this, the practice, to that relationship, you know what I mean? Like, make this actually about something bigger than him or her, yeah? Let's revisit it. I'm happy to talk individually too.
My anger is expressed internally as depression. It also is expressed outwardly as sarcasm. How do I cope with both of those?
I think you know, with the sarcasm piece, that's sort of that's the symptom, as you're saying, that's the symptom of the anger. And so instead of addressing the symptom, I think we go to the cause, you know. It's like you know, hopefully the day is relevant, you know. Yeah, because it's a big question, like, how do we deal with this? And how do we, there's a question around suppression there, you know, what is a balanced relationship with our emotional world? And I would say mindfulness practice, it's sort of the center point between rumination, obsessive thinking, entanglement, and on one end, and on the other end, suppression, driving it all inwards, kind of passive in our actions, but a lot going on inside of us. it's mindfulness is the midpoint between entanglement and suppression. And in that kind of balance point, we are learning to make peace with experience, to not fight with experience. And suppression is a fighting. Entanglement is like a clinging. It's both two sides of grasping, of clinging. And you know, part of my intention in being here today is to try to, you know, for us to explore what does it look like to find that balance point. You know? And you know, you're raising an important point, because we have very different anger styles. You know, there are some people in here where it's much more kind of explosive, and other people where it's really internalized and more passive. And you know, for me, part of why this subject is close to, we always teach what we need to hear, right? That is this is definitely close, you know, subject that's close to my heart. And I can say that Dharma practice has been very helpful in this regard. I would say that my style has been, you know, it's really well behaved, not a lot of anger outside of the immediate loved ones, but especially growing up, that's where it was. And and it was expressed, not internalized, yeah. And so, you know, for all of us, we kind of have to hear these words, you know, in our own way, right? Because you know, hopefully I'll sort of address different profiles of anger over the course of the day. But we need to sort of know what our profile is and what direction we want to head in. Because it's often around these kind of deep emotional habits, in general, the best direction is the opposite of what we've done. You know, like this is years and years ago, a Seinfeld episode where the kind of loserish character George decides to do everything exactly opposite to his impulses, and things start to go great for him, you know. And I'm not recommending that, but with our emotional habits, there's some real wisdom in, you know, if we're on the avoidant, suppressive side, to move into more engagement. If we're on the entangled, explosive side, to move, you know, this direction, right? So, anyway. So, some of this practice around anger, around meditation in general, is about learning techniques and strategies, and I'll cover some of that. But part of it is also about kind of setting up the view, you know, setting up the view of having a kind of seeding the mind with wisdom, of approaching situations with a kind of wholesome view. And It's interesting. As mindfulness becomes more and more, widely disseminated in the culture, and more kind of engagement in a lot of different secular domains, there's more and more emphasis on mindfulness as technique, and that is fine. There are really valuable techniques, but it's important not to reduce the practice to technique. And part of what we're doing is actually setting up ways of seeing that are helpful, ways of seeing that diffuse anger, ways of seeing that encourage love, ways of seeing that support peace. So the day will be a sort of a bit of a blend between between concrete practice and also lenses that are helpful for us in working with our inner emotional life. Now, one of the most important kind of lenses or aspects in this is the very basic Buddhist model of what happiness is, of what peace is. And, sometimes I feel self-conscious. Like, I often gravitate towards talking about suffering and anger and anxiety. And, I wanted to do a talk on mudita, sympathetic joy, delighting in the well-being of others, yeah? And so I sat down to sort of try to write an outline of that kind of talk. And this is a very kind of, beautiful state of the heart-mind to really delight in the well-being of others. But when I sat down to try to do this, I really couldn't say anything about sympathetic joy. But I had a lot to say about jealousy. Which is the flip side, yeah? And, part of this may just be my own weird mind, right? But part of it is something about the actual Buddhist approach to happiness. The model of well-being is not find happiness, go get it. It's much more dismantle the obstacles to happiness. It's much more see through, work through, practice through everything that obscures well-being. And so, and when we are through with suffering in a moment or a minute or an hour or a day, and maybe some people the rest of their life, but when we are through with suffering, it's not like we then have to go find happiness, right? It's not like the Buddha, as the story mythology goes, it's not like the Buddha was enlightened and he's sitting there under the Bodhi tree and then he was like, had the thought like, ice cream would make this better. Right? It's like not, that's just not it. No, it's like the moment was complete in itself. There is peace. And when there's peace, there's nothing missing. There's nothing missing. And this is the model of well-being, the model of happiness in Dharma. And so to me it feels much more, it feels more natural to approach difficulties rather than to talk about the results. Yeah, some teachers are really beautiful and inspiring in talking about the fruits and outcome of practice. And that's an important Dharma voice to have, for sure. And it's good also to be really direct about how do we untangle, how do we work with the difficulties. And so naturally the kind of topics that I'll be covering is sort of focused around that, yeah? In working with anger and with our emotional life more generally, I find it helpful to combine two perspectives. And they sound maybe like contradictory. The two perspectives are radical accountability on the one hand and non-self-blame on the other. Yeah. Radical accountability and non-self-blame. So what do I mean by each? The radical accountability side means that we are not disowning anger. The experience of anger, it strongly motivates us to pinpoint, to localize the problem as outside of oneself. Yeah? And so it's them, it's their behavior, it's their, it's their whatever, yeah? And it's, again, this is not to dismiss that, right? You know, like I was joking about, it's not okay to text on the highway or driving, right? It's not to dismiss that, but what this perspective of radical accountability is fully owning that the seeds of anger are within us. And those seeds get watered by lots of different people doing lots of different things, behaving in lots of ways that we object to, yeah? But actually owning that the seeds are in us, yeah? And maybe to make that clear, sometimes I think about, I'll get angry about something, and then it can be helpful for me to think, like, okay, what would happen if the Dalai Lama were here and the exact same thing happened to him as happened to me? What would arise in him? You know, and that's just an example, the Dalai Lama, yeah? But what would arise in him? And I can usually get just reflecting on that, I can get a little bit of a flavor of like, oh, I'm adding something to this. I'm adding something. Yeah. This is, my anger is not a necessary description of this situation, yeah? It's like I'm doing something to what's happening. And sometimes in that kind of moment, I can even envision how one might be more free of that. You know, just in that beautiful example of the Dalai Lama, I can get a little flavor for what his mind, you can only kind of imagine another person's mind, especially somebody who's practiced so long and deeply, but you can get a little flavor like, oh, he would see this differently. Yeah? And there's something very specific about my own response here that I'm contributing. Yeah? It's not the inherent state of things that anger must arise here. Yeah? So This is the side of radical accountability. Yeah. And again, this is not saying that we should be passive or we should condone what's happening or anything like that. But I am part of this. I am participating in anger. Yeah. And we can see, you know, over the course of our life, different things that would get me angry when I was 7 really would not get me angry now. Yeah. And we see actually that anger is a dependent arising. It arises out of a lot of different factors. One of which may be the person texting in the car, yeah? But there are other factors that are necessary, other ingredients in that dish to create the experience of anger. And I'm part of that. Yeah? That makes sense? So there's this radical owning of anger, of not externalizing, yeah? But the other side is so important too, which is the side of non-self blame. Yeah. So this means not, there's a kind of dignity and honor in owning anger. You know. The mind wants, I think, to externalize so much because it's actually hard to own it because it feels like there's something defective in us or there's something wrong that we're feeling this or we have, you know, we've heard a million teachings about non-harming and love and then we're like, what is this, you know? What is this? What's this anger, yeah? And we can actually become judgmental about our own emotional responses. Yeah? So there's a kind of perspective of like really, really welcoming, opening to our own experience of anger in a way that's not judging ourselves for feeling it. Yeah. So this is one perspective, this is one view of the mind that helps us do this. And it's not to say that it's the ultimate view or the right view or you need to take it up, but this is one of the ways that the Buddhist tradition talks about it to help us both be responsible for our responses, but also not be harsh with ourselves, not be blaming, to see the arising of anger as not having any meaning about who we are. We feel like it means something. Anger means something about who we are. And this gets challenged in our practice. So this is Ajahn Chah from the Thai forest tradition. About this mind, in truth, there's nothing really wrong with it. It's intrinsically pure. Within itself, it's already peaceful. That the mind is not peaceful these days is because it follows moods. It becomes peaceful or agitated because moods deceive it. The untrained mind gets lost and follows these things. It forgets itself. Our practice is simply to see the original mind. We must train the mind to know those sense impressions and not get lost in them. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through. Sometimes we can have the experience of maybe this purity of mind, that when we stop pushing and pulling on experience, when we really allow life to be as it is, the mind to be as it is, when we really open in that way to the moment, there is a kind of purity, maybe. There's a kind of the thought of doing harm to ourself or others is just so remote. It's it feels a million miles away when we come into that sort of open relationship with what's here now. And so we actually get a sense of there is a kind of innocence about my being. And something I'll talk more about through the day. There's a kind of innocence about my being. And that can become a sort of touch point for us to remember this side of non-self-blaming. Yeah. And when we can not take anger so personally and make it mean so much about who we are, it really opens us up to be fully responsible for it, too. Does that make sense? Like, if we're blaming and have a lot of harsh judgments about what anger is and why it comes up and what it means about me, if that's really in the view, it is so difficult to actually take responsibility for anger. One of the profound kind of aspects of retreat practice. How many people have done silent meditation retreat, residential retreat? Yeah. One of the very kind of common familiar experiences with that, because you're only tasked with paying attention, you know, like that's it. You have to find your way to the bathroom and to eat, but beyond that, those are your main jobs for the day. And even during those jobs, you're paying attention. Yeah. And so there's this continuity of attention. You actually get to see the mind build up these houses of cards and then see it collapse. A little bit like what you were talking about with, you know, hunger. And you see the mind build this huge house of cards and then you get to see it collapse. And on retreat, that whole process becomes really clear. And it's very helpful for us to begin to take responsibility for our emotional life. So there's a kind of state like that's called, it's so well known in the retreat world that it has a name, and it's called yogi mind. You know, that's usually what retreatants are called. Yogis is the traditional word. And so we were all on retreat, we'd all be yogis, and we would all very likely have the experience at some point over the course of the 3 days or a week or longer retreat of yogi mind. So yogi mind is when we get fixated on a really little detail and we get completely absorbed in it, and it feels like it's the most important thing on the planet, you know. And these are humbling experiences, yeah. Because we actually get to see the whole crescendo, yeah, of the mood and the stories and everything. We get to see it all build up and peak, and we get to the height of certainty where, you know, and this cannot go on. This is a crime against the world, you know. And it's my neighbor or something who's breathing a little loudly, right? I mean, that is like, that's the most common example. It's like, you're sitting next to somebody, they're breathing, maybe they're not breathing through their mouth or something, and it's a little loud, or they are sick and they're sniffling or something, and all of a sudden it's like, all of the attention gets gathered in their breath, and it's the only thing you hear, it's the only problem you have, and the only solution you can imagine is them leaving the retreat. Yeah. Is it, for the people who've been on retreat, does this happen? I'm not exaggerating. This is a bad advertisement for retreat. You should go. You should go. It's important. And part of why it's important is we actually get to see that, the whole gestalt of that, yeah? And we get really fixated, and then conditions change. And we kind of, for whatever reason, our own practice or just the unfolding of time, things change, and what was the centerpiece of our attention, we may completely forget about. And it's like waking up from a hallucination or a dream, you know, that we were so utterly certain about what had to change, what the world should be like, what they should be like, what, you know, we were so certain. And then it completely dissolves. And it is humbling to see that process. It really is humbling. And it's really important because we get to see how kind of insubstantial our views are, meaning how they felt like they were grounded in some ultimate reality, but they really just came out of very particular conditions. You know, feel like, you know, maybe I'm idling a little high emotionally, and yeah, they are breathing loudly, yeah? And then there's this whole dance between what's going on in me and what's going on in the world, and it takes on this whole thing. And then the house of cards collapse, and we get to see in a very clear and humbling and important way, I was participating. Like, that's the insight. I was participating. Retreats are great for this, but we don't even need to be on retreats to do that, yeah? We can inspect, like, how are we participating? And that view gets married to the non-self-blaming. And this is the basic kind of approach from which I think we can work productively with anger. Maybe pause for a minute. Anything coming up for you, or any questions?
Yeah, I was just thinking earlier, I tend to do a lot of self-blaming, when I feel angry, I usually try to distance myself or separate myself from the story of it and just kind of allow it to pass. But sometimes I miss the fact that my reactivity might be because I haven't maybe spoken up for what I need in the situation,
yeah,
or taking care of myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that kind of falls by the wayside.
Right, yeah. Right. Did people here in the back know? So just to paraphrase, the general approach of working with anger as separating from the story and allowing it to pass, but then also seeing that sometimes he's neglecting his own needs and speaking up appropriately. Yeah, and yeah, this is something I'll talk about a bit later, but just real briefly, to speak, to share what is making us angry in a non-angry way, that is a very profound and vulnerable gesture. You know, to give somebody the finger, that's not making us vulnerable, yeah? Like that's creating a lot of strong barrier, yeah? Or to yell or whatever it may be, right? But to actually say, I am angry, you know, like what can we do? That is a very vulnerable gesture, because we're actually announcing a need, and we're announcing that we can be hurt. Yeah? Which is the truth about anger, that we can, anger testifies to the fact that we can be hurt. And in the angry state, that's the last thing we want to focus on, is our own vulnerability. But this is to be human is to be vulnerable. And how we come, you know, a lot of the Dharma path, a lot of this practice is a kind of coming to terms with our own vulnerability, of having a wise relationship with vulnerability, which actually makes us strong and stable, yeah? But we begin with a wise relationship with vulnerability, that we can be hurt. Yeah. And that's what's disavowed in anger. That's what we never want to acknowledge in the moment of anger, is I am hurt. Yeah. So I'll talk more about it. Yeah.
So in my work in prisons, you know, we've talked about this idea around anger as often as a secondary emotion. It's a reaction, actually, to our own hurt, our own pain, or to fear.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's just the acknowledgement of my own hurt or my own fear to see that sometimes that is the seed, basically, for anger to really come out, is that we experience this deep contraction, and the first thing that happens is, you know, we want to strike out,
yeah,
because of the contraction that we're feeling. And so I think that piece about the no blame, or the way I'm kind of phrasing it for myself, is this ability to have self-compassion, to say, I'm experiencing this, it's difficult, and then can I not try to push it away or try to deny it or try to some way pretend it's not there, but to actually embrace it. And in that embracing, that's where this vulnerability comes in, is that we have to be willing to touch that.
Great, thanks. Yeah, a couple more. Okay.
I'm really feeling the framework idea of being more skillful in doing that. I also work with kids exposed to trauma, domestic violence, and sexual abuse, and that many of them don't possess the knowledge yet to even slow things down enough to realize that anything's happening. It's like 0 to 10, and they're hitting, or they're cutting themselves. So I'm looking forward later in the day to more concrete practice about how to build some breathe some space around the moment that anger is arising. And in fact, it doesn't go from 0 to 10. There's steps along the way that we can pick up on.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, one more. Go ahead.
Is it fair to say that self-anger is really just self-blame?
That self-anger is just self-blame?
Yeah. Or is there...
Can you say a little bit more?
I find it easier for my anger to dissipate towards others much more readily than when I'm mad at myself or angry at myself. How am I going to hang on to? It's harder to let go. So is that just sort of excessive self-blame, or is there a little twist in there that I'm not seeing?
It is a deep habit. Sometimes we really, it's like we try to motivate ourselves by hating ourselves a little bit, you know? And it's really strong. I know, I've had experiences where, something will go wrong or something's not happening how I want it, and it's like I can't find anyone else to blame. And so I'm like, okay, my best choice is me, you know, like I'll take it, right? And the way it works in my mind is it's like a little bit of an attempt to it's like discharging some feeling. It's like just like this broad objection to what is happening, and then it gets channeled in a very direct way. But it's like it's so misdirected in a way, yeah. And it's an attempt to motivate myself. And this is the thing: it sometimes kind of works, yeah. See, that's the messed up part about it. It's like, it sometimes kind of works. It doesn't work for an abiding peace in our life, yeah? But it sometimes can get us to try a little harder, run a little faster, do whatever, you know? And so it's harder to give things up when they actually partially serve a function, yeah? And I think that's true more generally in anger, is to actually to lash out or lash in. It discharges, like the RPMs come down a bit from 1500. It comes down to 1000. Now, of course, it's reinforcing a habit that's likely to get us into complications later, yeah? But in that moment, there's a little bit of relief. And part of what we're learning to do is to renounce that relief. Yeah. So, get into that. So I think let's take a break. Let's do it. Okay to do it in silence, and we'll build some continuity. Does that sound okay to you? So I'll ring the bell in maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And something that I say often is that where the mind goes when we don't think we're supposed to be paying attention is really important. So, you know, it's like that default position of the mind, like the place, we can already probably almost taste where the mind is going to go. Like once I stop talking and where there's the break, right? You can kind of like, the mind goes to a particular place, right? Is it just me or no? It's like it goes somewhere and it's like, oh yeah, this is my break time and this is where the mind goes and this is where I go emotionally and this is what I think about and that feels like home, right? It's like this, just listening to Matthew, but then I'm going to go home to that place of home, yeah? And that's a very cozy kind of place, yeah? And it feels like our home base. That's fine. But it's not It's not more real than this mind now listening. And it's not actually a home. It feels like a home, but there are other places to live too. Yeah. So this whole, you know, where the mind goes, there's a whole kind of network of brain regions associated with it. It even has a name, it's called the default mode network, right? And some people in here may know a lot more about it than me, but it's the kind of thing that's caught the attention of people who do research in mindfulness, because where does the mind go when we don't think we're supposed to pay attention to anything? This is important, and we can learn something about ourselves. So it's not like you have to fight to effortfully be mindful. You don't have to fight. You don't have to fight. Let the mind do what it does, and see what one can be aware of. You'll get pulled into that place that feels like home, and see what you can be aware of. The kind of awareness that's not effortful at all. Yeah. So that's our way of saying this break is not a break. But relax deeply, enjoy it, stretch the body, enjoy that the mind, you know, enjoy that the mind can meander too, like actually taste the enjoyment of that too. Yeah. That's part of being aware. It's like, oh, I want to think about lunch or this or that, or yeah, so enjoy. Do really enjoy. Okay, I'll see you in a few minutes.